This Mark Germain podcast on TalkRadio1.com brought to you in part by the law offices of Glenn Stern. With the legal alternative to foreclosure, call 1-866-924-4449 for information about loan modification. This is TalkRadio1.com. I am Mark Germain, broadcasting live from Los Angeles. On tonight's show, Dr. Raj, the Beverly Hills orthopedist, will explain what he's doing to make healthcare more affordable. And since he was raised in Canada and went to medical school in Canada, he'll tell us which one's better, which serves patients better, the Canadian system or ours. Now, having never been treated in Canada, I can tell you theirs works better than ours. We'll talk with Dr. Raj in just a few minutes. Also, Andrew Roche from TechPresident.com has been watching how the presidential campaigns use technology. We'll talk with Andrew Roche from TechPresident.com coming up a little bit later on the show. But first...
And now, Talk Radio 1 presents Meryl Marco with more lovely stories.
In our first installment of Meryl Marco's Lovely Stories... We welcome Meryl Marco to Talk Radio 1. Hello, Meryl.
Now, that's a beautiful theme, isn't it?
It is lovely, yes. It's very soothing. You know, I was...
I went for soothing. I thought soothing really was the right way to go.
Gets you in the mood for what I think you might have in store for us. What? Well, let's just sort of explain the premise of Meryl Marco's Lovely Stories.
Uh-huh. Well, the premise was that before I started telling you the lovely stories, I was just sort of screaming them out in my home to the man with whom I live. They're the things that I find in the newspaper that I just have to tell someone. I can't let it pass and throw the paper out. And I still get a paper, by the way. I'm afraid to cancel it because I'm afraid I'm going to be the straw that breaks the camel's back and the whole thing will crumble because of my lack of subscription.
Yeah, too late for that. The newspapers are already crumbling. Which newspaper are you referring to?
I'm talking about the New York Times, which I really enjoy.
Uh-huh.
But, I mean, I'll be sad when I don't get it, although I could get it online, but I'm afraid to stop getting it in the driveway. I'm frightened.
But don't you feel like you're increasing your carbon footprint by having the paper delivered? I mean, think about the trees, the delivery trucks, the ink, the...
Yeah, I guess so, to say nothing of the incidental monetary loss.
That too, yeah. The fact that you can get it for free... It's updated, whereas the dirty paper with the ink on it is already a day old by the time you read it. Well, not quite a day old, probably about 10 hours old.
But I will say this. I read a paper that I have in my hands more carefully. Like the stuff usually that will become a lovely story are things that I open up and read the back page on.
Uh-huh.
You know, I mean, you get a little hit of it in some earlier page.
Right.
And then when you get to the page at the end, you go, oh, my God, what are you saying?
You have to go deep, in other words. You can't just read the headlines. You've got to go in the back pages of the New York Times. And other places, you're also finding some of these stories on the Internet as well?
Well, no. These are all, today's are all coming out of the newspaper.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it's mainly the newspaper because the Internet, we all see those. And I don't know about you, but I don't tend to read a full article on the Internet. I read... whatever the headlines are and a little bit of the original page, but I don't go, there's too much else to look at on the Internet, you know? You don't really sit there and read the rest of the story.
Mm-hmm. What are you looking on the Internet?
What kind of things?
Yeah, what websites do you go to to find stories, to find something that interests you, that makes you laugh?
Well, actually, I have,
you?
I check that Huffington Post quite a bit, and then to see what the other side says.
Are you writing for them, by the way?
You know, I can, but I don't usually because of an assorted set of complex reasons that I don't know that we need to get into right now.
Mostly because they don't pay?
Yeah, there's that. And I put a lot of time into when I write. I mean, it takes me hours and hours and hours. And then sometimes, you know, you write it for free and then it winds up on a back page and it's gone in a minute and you go, so why did I just spend 6 hours and not get paid and write this thing
again?
Well,
she does have an incredible, Arianna Huffington does have an incredible business model. Pay no one.
She's amazing. She is amazing. I mean, we all have to stand in awe.
Yeah. Well, you know what she's trying? You know what her next thing is? I don't know if you've been reading about this, and I'm not sure if I read about it in the New York Times or someone else. I think maybe it was the New Yorker magazine covered this, that her plan is to roll out She wants to go head to head with legitimate newspapers in various cities. So, you know, like the Chicago Sun-Times.
She already is, isn't she?
She wants to do a local version of the Huffington Post with real reporters in local markets. So she wants to, that's how she wants to go up again. Not linking to the other stories.
You want to get that?
No.
That's the nice part about doing a show like this is you get to take calls, actual calls.
Yeah. In fact, you know what? Let me do that. I actually don't have the call incoming call system running. Let me fire that up. If people want to call in and comment about the stories they're hearing Meryl talk about, or maybe if you found a story that you think Meryl should, a lovely story that you think Meryl should
know about.
It has to
be a lovely story.
The telephone number to call is area code 213-341-4353.
And by the way, I don't actually find these stories lovely. It's just that I always say to the guy that I live with before I tell him about him, hey, here's another lovely story.
Yeah. It's really the stuff that unnerves you, that gets you irate.
Or surreal.
Stories that you just cannot believe that this is happening and no one's talking about it.
I'm starting with surreal because I am way into the Ted Stevens senatorial.
This is not getting a lot of play. When you think about it, this is a how many terms has he been senator in Alaska?
Like, let's see,
it's like 30 years or something, right?
A long time. He's 84.
Yeah, and he just looks like he's almost a cartoonish version of a corrupt senator.
Yeah, he is. He looks like a Simpson rendering.
He's right out of central casting because he's got all the aspects of a.
He's been in the Senate 40 years.
40 years. Wow. Yeah. I thought it was 30. Yeah. Okay. So that just tells you what kind of guy this is. And what's interesting is he was the Bridge to Nowhere guy.
Yeah.
And
a big supporter of Sarah Palin.
A big supporter of Sarah Palin.
And vice versa.
Yeah. Although now it's become he's political poison. He's political uranium. And so she doesn't cozy up or talk about him. Or say that they're, you know, in the Mutual Admiration Society. But anyway, he's on trial, and it's based on that he had
ethics
a contractor.
Violations.
Yeah, ethics violations. He had a contractor do $250,000 worth of renovation on his house, and he and his wife say, well, we didn't do anything unethical or illegal, and it's just a misunderstanding. We just weren't paying close attention. I love that they weren't paying close attention because I know when someone gives me $250,000 worth of services, I don't really have time to go over the paperwork.
But they're not just services. They're things like they had their house lifted up off of its foundation and they've had a new staircase put in and lighting put in outside. And they're saying, well, they didn't necessarily want those things. They were just gifts. They didn't even ask for them.
Yeah.
They weren't even needed or wanted.
What? Lifting my house? Who asked you to do that?
It's very, very funny. Can I get into the particulars?
Yeah, please.
Or do you want to take your phone call?
No. Go ahead. No, I want to hear from you.
All right. So the principals in this are somebody named Brenda Morris, who's the prosecutor, and also testifying for the prosecution is somebody named Bill Allen, who is the man who gave the gifts to Senator Stevens.
Oh, it was just
one oil man.
Just one guy. Oh, and he just happens to be in the oil business. Okay.
Yeah.
Because it's not like he's a contractor who wanted to help out an elderly senator.
No, he's he's testifying for the prosecution.
Oh, wow. Okay, good.
So that's partially why it's completely hilarious.
Right.
But let me just read you this little section of the back and forth between the prosecuting attorney and Mr. Stevens.
Wouldn't you assume that the reason why this guy is this oil man is testifying for the prosecution is because he also has committed crimes that he likely got immunity for in exchange for his testimony against the good senator?
That must be the only reason.
Okay.
How else could it happen?
An oil guy? Right.
Yeah, it's a very, very unsavory but completely hilarious group of people. So anyway, the prosecutor is named Brenda Morris, and she, Mr. Stevens decided to take the stand in his own behalf, which is always a good sign.
Yeah.
So he says many of the expensive items he had received from a friend were not gifts because he did not ask for them and even regarded them as useless burdens forced on him. You didn't want the lights, Miss Morris asked, referring to devices that Bill Allen, an oil services tycoon, had installed outside Mr. Stevens' home. No, he snapped. She went on to list other items Mr. Allen had provided, including a steel staircase, a deck, a generator, a toolbox, and a gas grill. "Didn't he want these gifts?" she asked. "You're making a lot of assumptions," he said. She says to him, "You were the lion of the Senate," referring to Mr. Stevens' reputation as formidable legislator for 40 years, "and you didn't know how to stop a man from putting unwanted things in your home?" Mr. Stevens said Mr. Allen had continually lied to him and had become difficult to deal with after he had a motorcycle injury. He apparently was in a motorcycle accident and had a head injury. And that got Mr. Allen just so out of his mind. He was putting gifts in people's homes and not telling them.
I know, because I had a motorcycle accident, and that's exactly what I started doing after.
They call it Santa syndrome, I think.
Can you imagine the jury is listening to this and not guffawing or not snickering at what they're hearing?
It says they were sitting quietly.
Oh, that's a bad sign.
It says prosecutors contend that the renovations and the gifts were so extensive that Mr. and Mrs. Stevens had to know they were getting an enormous amount of value free. And here's where it gets really, really wonderful. This is Saturday's news, by the way. I'm about to get to today's. They closed the trial up today. So on Saturday, this Mr. Allen talked about how he and Stevens had collaborated on a cover story. So that they apparently Stevens sent him a note that said he was grateful to Mr. Allen for the offer of the gifts, but he was bound by Senate ethic rules and would send a personal emissary to discuss the billing situation. And then after he sent that, he also sent the emissary, who came to Mr. Allen and said that Mr. Stevens did not expect to be billed because he was sending the messages to create a false record to protect himself.
Because most people do that in business. That's a good way to, you know, cover your bases. Sure.
So they have all this stuff as evidence in the case.
Well, it's interesting that he took the stand, and you always think that people who don't take the stand must be guilty, although you're admonished as a juror to not make that assumption, that people do not have an obligation to testify, and so you cannot make any conclusions about their unwillingness to testify. My guess is that his lawyers told him, don't do this, but he's an old gas bag and thought, you know what, I've hoodwinked better than these 12 stooges in the jury. I'll get up in my own defense and I'll just be a persnickety old senator and say, how dare you ask me that question? And
he was outraged. And today we're closing arguments, and apparently he's got a trial lawyer who is every bit the showman and blustering gas bag that he is. He's got somebody named Brendan Sullivan, who today's
story sounds really familiar. Yeah, that name sounds really familiar. He's a high profile guy.
That's what it says. His style is renowned enough to have filled the courtroom with fellow lawyers to witness his performance. He was much the showman. As he railed against the government, he paced the courtroom, bent over to embrace the lectern, put both hands to the side of his head as if the charges were too painful to bear, and waved his arms.
What a show trial. How great. Well,
is
it over?
And his quote is, "The prosecution's case is crazy. They're trying to convict an innocent man by submitting this courtroom to evidence that is so far from real life that it should make you sick."
Is the trial over, and is the jury, do they have the case?
Well, the closing arguments, and the last thing that Miss Morris, the prosecuting attorney, said was they were trying to pin the whole thing on Mrs. Stevens, who Mr. Stevens is saying was in charge of all the money. He doesn't wash. He is not looking into that bill paying
stuff. These guys hide behind their wives' skirts every single time they get in trouble. That's the same thing. Remember the guy, the Top Gun guy down in Orange County, did the same thing. The congressman that went to prison, Randall Duke Cunningham. Remember
he did
the same thing when he was getting Oriental rugs, and he was getting all kinds of Rolls Royces, all kinds of things from defense contractors, and he said, "No, it was my wife."
Oh, I love that.
Yeah, it's so classy.
A prosecuting attorney had a very funny line. She told the jury of Mrs. Stevens, "That woman is still recovering from the bus he threw her under."
That's great. He's going down. My prediction, I mean, you never know. It's always a roll of the dice with a jury, but how could he not? Yeah, it's so transparent. And the indignation, you know, how dare you ask me that question? And I've never taken I've earned everything I have being a senator for 40 years.
And the other guy testifying for the prosecution, what leg does this guy have to stand on? It's really funny. So
that is a lovely story. Yes, thank you. What else?
That pretty much qualifies as a lovely story.
Absolutely, it does. It'll even be more lovely when you recount how he's been found guilty on. How many charges does he have against him? Do you know?
7 felony counts of failure to report gifts from home remodeling services.
See, here's my prediction. He'll be found guilty, and then he'll fake some kind of health claim. You know, he's got a heart condition, or he's got Alzheimer's or something.
Or his wife does.
Yeah, that will prevent him from actually going behind bars. But I suspect this is big enough that they, if the prosecutors are willing to take it to trial like this, they want to see him behind bars. So, But you watch. There'll be a. I'm a sick old man. Why are you putting me in jail? I've admirably served.
A parallel, but different sort of a note about another sick older person. This is did you happen to catch the story that was in Saturday in the LA Times about a woman named Ahedo Camargo? I think he would say A-G-E-D-A.
No,
would you say Ahedo, would you think?
Unless
it's Agada.
All right.
I don't know how it's said.
What about her?
Well, she lives in La Quinta, and she is. They're threatening to put her in jail. She's 83, and before I tell you what she did, I'd like to also mention that she's undergone 3 surgeries in the last 2 years. She had breast cancer. She had a brain surgery, and she's 83.
Okay.
And they're threatening to put her in jail because she owns a house where, when she bought the house, it had a converted garage.
Mm-hmm.
But apparently she didn't look into whether or not permits had been obtained.
Oh, you
got to
be kidding me. You got to be kidding me.
No. So that's what the story is. They're getting ready to throw her in jail. They
Oh, come on.
A grandmother of 6. Well, listen to this story. The city near Palm Springs, La Quinta, which I'm not familiar with. Are you?
Yeah.
One of her 3 bedrooms is really illegally converted. For 18 months now, code enforcement officials have been after Camargo to turn the bedroom back into a garage. She says, "I never had a garage. I bought it without a garage. I'm not now going to turn it into a garage." They apparently, when she refused, and some enforcement official noticed all of this by the fact that she had committed the horrible violation of, she had a light that was shining out from the garage onto the street, which is apparently some sort of infraction. And also she had her garbage cans out in front of her house, which is some kind of infraction. So given those kinds of frightening clues, they busted in on her. They pulled her grandson, who sleeps in this converted garage, out of bed. They asked for his IDs. When he asked, "What's this about?" they handcuffed him.
Wow.
And now they're threatening to put her in jail.
Wow. And, because all the other crimes in La Quinta have been solved, they can go after this woman. Wow, that's unbelievable.
Yeah. She says, "I never had a garage. I don't need one. I don't want one." So there you go. So there's an old person for whom the illness excuse is not working.
No, apparently not. It's just,
oh, that it, is a boy. Lovely story.
Yeah,
isn't it?
You know, they didn't pull Ted Stevens out of bed and put handcuffs on him, but a grandson sleeping in his grandmother's converted garage. There's a crime worthy of a tasering.
Yeah, he says they pushed right in. The grandson says, "Wow. I said, 'What's this about?' They were busy taking pictures. When I asked why they were taking pictures, the police asked for my ID. I asked why they needed my ID, and they put me in handcuffs."
Wow,
that's that old scary garage bedroom thing. That
you don't know what he could have been doing in there.
Yeah, you don't. When it was a garage, you know he's going to be parking his car, period, right?
Meryl Marco has lovely stories. What else you have?
Well, those were 2 of my most...
I have one for you that I thought was pretty interesting. This is a story. It's actually a letter that was sent. There's a guy in Santa Monica who ran a capital management company. His name is Andrew Lahde, L-A-H-D-E. I think that's how you pronounce the name. And he ran a hedge fund called Lottie Capital Management.
Mm-hmm.
And he decided to, this is a fund that was up 10,000%. So in other words, if you put in 1 year, if you put in $10,000 last year, you'd have $1 million today. That's how much.
My God.
This had, yeah, I mean, it's unbelievable returns, right? He's decided to shut, you know what he invested in, of course.
Oil?
No, close. He bet against the banks. He shorted the banks that were all in this, you know, subprime meltdown, right?
How do you do that?
Well,
that's probably complicated, right?
I think it is a little complicated, but in basically what you do is when you short a stock, you're basically saying that you believe the share price will go down. So you are buying other people's shares at a lower price.
Oh.
Right? So that's how we made these just astronomical returns. People wonder what happened to all the money. Well, it went to funds like this Lottie Capital Management. So this guy, I suspect he's relatively young because he refers to smoking pot.
Mm-hmm.
And he's
that could also make him a baby boomer.
Could be, yeah. It's hard to say, but when I read what he wrote, this is on October 17th, so that was like maybe Thursday or Friday of last week. When was this? Yeah. He sent out a letter to all the investors saying, I'm shutting down the fund, and here's the letter that he wrote. I just think this is amazing. Today I write not to gloat. Given the pain that nearly everyone has experienced, that would be entirely inappropriate. Nor am I writing to make further predictions, as most of my forecasts and previous letters have unfolded or are in the process of unfolding. Instead, I'm writing to say goodbye. Recently, on the front page of Section C of the Wall Street Journal, a hedge fund manager who was also closing up shop, a $300 million fund, was quoted as saying, "What I have learned about the hedge fund business is that I hate it." I could not agree more with that statement. I was in this game for the money, the low-hanging fruit, i.e. idiots whose parents paid for prep school, Yale, and then Harvard MBA. They were there for the taking. These people, who were often truly not worthy of the education they received or supposedly received, rose to the top of companies such as AIG, Bear Stearns, and Lehman Brothers, and at all levels of our government. All of this behavior supporting the aristocracy only ended up making it easier for me to find people stupid enough to take the other side of my trades. God bless America. There are far too many people for me to sincerely thank for my success. However, I do not want to sound like a Hollywood actor accepting an award. The money was reward enough. Furthermore, the endless list of those deserving thanks know who they are. I will no longer manage money for other people or institutions. I have enough of my own wealth to manage. Some people who think I have arrived at some reasonable estimate of my net worth might be surprised that I would call it quits with such a, quote, small war chest. That's fine. I'm content with my rewards. Moreover, I will let others try to amass 9, 10, or 11-figure net worths. Meanwhile, their lives suck. Appointments, back-to-back, booked solid for the next 3 months. They look forward to their 2-week vacation in January, during which they will likely be glued to their BlackBerries or other such devices. What's the point? They will all be forgotten in 50 years anyway. Steve Ballmer, Stephen Cohen, Larry Ellison, they will all be forgotten. I do not understand the legacy thing. Nearly everyone will be forgotten. Give up on leaving your mark. Throw the BlackBerry away and enjoy life. So this is it. With all due respect, I'm dropping out. Please do not expect any type of reply to emails or voicemails within normal time frames or at all. Andy Springer and his company will be handling the dissolution of the fund. And don't worry about my employees. They were always employed by Mr. Springer's company, and only one who has been well rewarded will lose his job. I have no interest in any deals in which anyone would like me to participate. I truly do not have a strong opinion about any markets right now, other than to say that things will continue to get worse for some time, probably years. I am content sitting on the sidelines and waiting. After all, sitting and waiting is how we made all the money from the subprime debacle. Now I have time to repair my health, which was destroyed by all the stress I layered unto myself over the last 2 years, as well as my entire life where I had to compete for spaces in universities and graduate schools, jobs, and assets under management, with all those who had the advantages, rich parents, that I did not. May meritocracy be part of the new form of government which needs to be established? Mm. On the is this interesting or am I boring
yeah.
you yet?
Okay. Yeah. Wow. I put this guy's age at 31.
That's about what I'm thinking too. On the issue of the U.S. government, I would like to make a modest proposal. First, I point out the obvious flaws whereby legislation was repeatedly brought forth to Congress over the past 8 years, which would have reined in the predatory lending practices of now mostly defunct institutions. These institutions regularly filled the coffers of both parties in return for voting down all of this legislation designed to protect the common citizen. This is an outrage, yet no one seems to know or to care about it. Since Thomas Jefferson and Adam Smith passed, I would argue that there has been a dearth of worthy philosophers in this country, at least ones focused on improving government. Capitalism worked for 200 years, but times change, and systems become corrupt. George Soros, a man of staggering wealth, has stated that he would like to be remembered as a philosopher. My suggestion is that this great man start and sponsor a forum for great minds to come together to create a new system of government that truly represents the common man's interest, while at the same time creating rewards great enough to attract the best and brightest minds to serve in government roles without having to rely on corruption to further their interests or lifestyles. This forum could be similar to the one used to create the operating system, Linux, which competes with Microsoft's near monopoly. I believe there is an answer, but for now, the system is clearly broken. Lastly, while I still have an audience, I would like to bring attention to an alternative food and energy source. You won't see it included in BP's Feel Good. We are working on sustainable solutions, television commercials, nor is it mentioned in ADM's similar commercials. But hemp but hemp has been used for at least 5,000 years for cloth and food, as well as just about everything that is produced from petroleum products. Hemp is not marijuana and vice versa. Hemp is the male plant, and it grows like a weed, hence the slang term. The original American flag was made of hemp fibers, and our Constitution was printed on paper made of hemp. It was used as recently as World War II by the U.S. government and then promptly made illegal after the war was won.
Is this signed Woody Harrelson?
No. This guy's name is Andrew Lottie. Uh-huh. Though he does live in Santa Monica, so let's see here.
I changed my estimate of his age to 38.
At a time when rhetoric is flying about becoming more self-sufficient in terms of energy, why is it illegal to grow this plant in this country? Ah, the female. The evil female plant, marijuana. It gets you high. It makes you laugh. It does not produce a hangover. Unlike alcohol, it does not result in bar fights or wife beating. So why is this innocuous plant illegal? Is it a gateway drug? No, that would be alcohol, which is so heavily advertised in this country. My only conclusion as to why it is illegal is that corporate America, which owns Congress, would rather sell you Paxil, Zoloft, Xanax, and other addictive drugs than allow you to grow a plant in your home without some of the profits going into their coffers. This policy is ludicrous. It has surely contributed to their dependency on foreign energy sources. Our policies have other countries literally laughing at our stupidity, most notably Canada, as well as several European nations, both Eastern and Western. You would not know this by paying attention to the U.S. media sources, though, as they tend to not elaborate on who is laughing at the United States this week. Please, people, let's stop the rhetoric and start thinking about how we can truly become self-sufficient. With that, I say goodbye and good luck. All the best, Andrew Lottie.
When he had this hedge fund, were there? I'm not sure what a hedge fund is. Does that mean that a lot of people had invested with
yes,
him?
Yes, right, exactly.
So did he stiff them all?
No, you manage other people's money. No, they got these enormous returns. They got these 10,000%.
But in him closing down the fund, they just that's the end of their
that's
free...
it. I'm no longer investing your money. Here is the profits that we made return to you in the percentage that you contributed.
Right.
Yeah. Oh. So no, everyone walks away happy, except I think people were hoping this guy would keep, you know, he's the goose that lays the golden eggs. I think there were probably a lot of people that said, well, why would you give up now? You're doing so well.
You know, on a sort of slightly related topic, that's very amazing.
Yeah.
You kind of got to admire the guy, sort of.
Yes and no, but he also sounds like a complete crackpot, you know, in a lot of ways. I mean, I like that someone's sort of sticking it to the powerful ones that fell and laughing at their losses that made it into his pockets. I admire that. What I'm not sure about is it does. First of all, it almost sounds like a suicide note, doesn't it?
It does.
Yeah, I mean, it starts.
I also was interested in his assessment of the whole financial crisis and its origins, because that's, you know, I don't know about you, but you probably have a pretty good grasp of it. I've been trying really hard to understand something about what happened, and I don't have a very good grasp of that kind of thing at all. So every time I see a lovely story like this one, which was entitled from Saturday's New York Times, FBI struggling to handle wave of finance cases, I read it just trying to learn something.
Yeah.
And we find out that the Federal Bureau of Investigation doesn't have enough agents to investigate criminal wrongdoing tied to the country's economic crisis because they laid off so many FBI people after 9/11.
Well, that's interesting in and of itself, but you'd also think if you really understood these markets and how they operate and all the sophisticated transactions that were going on, you could make a lot more money by being involved in those transactions than you could working for the FBI.
Ah.
So wouldn't that be the other problem? I mean, you know, if you really have an understanding and know how these markets can be manipulated, wouldn't you be the guy doing the manipulation of the markets and
sort of like what happens?
Profits?
You mean when the border guards pick up somebody with a ton of drugs and then they end up taking some of it and selling it?
Yeah, exactly.
That's possible. Well, this is what the article goes on to say.
Except the border guard knows what he's doing is illegal, whereas the guy who understands how to manipulate the markets in a legal way and can make a killing. Would you rather do that or work for the FBI?
So you think there's a lot of FBI crossover into the financial markets?
No. But generally, you know, most of these guys that work at the FBI or work for the Justice Department usually come right out of law school, and they do this for a couple years, and then they go into business. They go and work for, you know, Lehman Brothers, or they go work for. Because that's a great thing on your resume that you worked for the government, and that's who usually will give you your first break.
Well, here's what the back page of this article goes on to say that I found pretty astonishing. That made me yell out, "Oh, that's a lovely story!" Several former law enforcement officials said in interviews that senior administration officials, particularly at the White House and the Treasury Department, had made clear to them that they were concerned the Justice Department and the FBI were taking an anti-business attitude that could chill corporate risk-taking. So they told them to lay off of corporate crime.
Well, that doesn't
surprise. Isn't that amazing?
No, it's not amazing to me at all. This was an administration for the last 8 years that believed in laissez-faire capitalism. Let the invisible hand of the market take care of the problems. Unleash capitalists, and you will see all, you know, a rising tide will raise all ships. And so the idea was, if you start breathing down the necks of people who are at the center of generating profits, then you're likely to screw up the machine that's going to, fund the nation, that will keep prosperity in this nation. And
but you don't really hear anybody saying that sort of thing now that they're analyzing it. They're talking about bad mortgages.
Oh, absolutely, I do. You hear saying this is guys like the Cato Institute, which are supposed to be libertarian think tanks. They're mm-hmm. they're the guys that are on all the talk shows saying the problem wasn't regulation, the problem wasn't deregulation. The problem is that there wasn't enough deregulation. That markets weren't deregulated. If there had been no regulation, and then these markets would have functioned much more smoothly, and we wouldn't have these problems. Oh, I hear lots of conservatives
saying that. I've heard that. I mean, I'm just saying, like this. This is the other paragraph that I circled here. This spring and summer, as public concerns about the subprime mortgage crisis were growing, Attorney General Michael B. Mukasey rejected repeated calls for the creation of a national task force like the one used after the Enron collapse.
Well, and that was another, you know, I watched that.
He rejected calls for a task force about the subprime problem.
Mm-hmm.
Don't you think that's kind of amazing?
It's only amazing if you consider that the administration wanted to keep this train rolling along because it was the engine for the economy, that it was all based on consumer spending, based on rising home prices.
Based on debt, consumer debt.
Of course it's debt. Yeah, but that's I mean, there is something to be said that you have to have a certain level of debt to have an economy that functions. We could eliminate
functions on interest, I guess.
Well, yeah, but I mean, there are other societies. For example, did you know in Islam, interest is against the Quran? That they don't have Muslim lenders. That they don't do that.
Now there is something sensible about Islam, after all.
See, I don't think that is sensible because you without interest, you can't. Well, here's the proof. Name a Muslim country that has a successful economy that's not based on oil. I mean, if you take oil out of the equation, Saudi Arabia's got nothing.
What about Dubai?
Well, Dubai is built on credit. They just do a different form of credit. They don't do interest credit. But Dubai is also based on oil. The guy who's the sheikh who's running Dubai made his fortune in oil.
Yeah,
those Emirates are all oil based. So, but I mean, they're trying to do something different. Whereas they're trying to build. Dubai is trying to build a modern city.
Or Disneyland.
Yeah, it is kind of a Disneyland. It's incredible what the growth is. But it's not. There's not a lot of. It doesn't seem like there's a lot to do there. I mean, they have that indoor skiing, but other than that, what are you going to do?
And then did you see that? I saw some report, I think it was 60 Minutes, that showed how somebody is building fingers of like peninsulas that go out into the ocean.
It's the same guy. It's the same
beachfront property on both sides of the road.
Yeah, it's that same guy that's doing all of this. He's the mastermind behind all of this. But yeah, and they've sold out. They've built those properties and they're sold out.
Yeah, amazing.
It is amazing, but who wants to go to Dubai? I mean, it kind of looks like an interesting place to visit, but you want to be
out. It looks like a crazy place to visit. It's
like
kind
crazy,
of like a cross between Las Vegas and some that Roger Rabbit world.
Yeah, but at least in Vegas, there's entertainment. I mean, there's gambling and there's, celebrities, comedy shows and singers, and there's something to do.
You don't think those people will go to Dubai?
Maybe.
All you have to do is wink at them?
Maybe. It seems like the only entertainment they have is camel and horse racing.
Well, you don't need more. All the celebrities like to attend that. They don't even feel
but
like
it's very
doing
interesting.
The show.
It's very interesting that Muslims, because they don't believe in credit, they don't believe in interest, and they can't. You cannot borrow or lend. There is a way in Sharia law that you can borrow and lend, but they don't call it interest. They have another way of sort of, it's like a smokescreen for basically the same thing, which is, I'll give you this much money, and in over time, you'll have to give me that much money back plus more.
It's a dowry.
Kind of, yeah.
Marriage dowry.
Kind of, but it's interesting that the point I was trying to make is without credit, you cannot have an economy. You have to have people willing to lend and borrow in order to build great things. They can't be done by individuals. Just it's not possible.
All right. You say so.
Well, think about you. Could you have bought your house?
I don't do anything on credit.
You have,
I always pay off my full bill every month.
I do too,
everything.
But you couldn't have bought your house for cash when you bought
it. That's true.
And who could? Who could? Who has that kind of money? I mean, maybe the guy from the United Arab Emirates, but from Dubai. But other than that, we all need something to be able. And that's good. It's good that you pay a little extra, and that goes back into the system that other people can then borrow and buy their homes and they can buy. Credit is not a bad thing. It's when credit becomes so loose and so easy that people who can't ever repay the debt get the money. That's the real problem. And that's what we were seeing. I was talking about this 4 years ago. I was saying, I just don't understand how people with $40,000 and $50,000 a year incomes can buy $500,000 and $600,000 homes. They'll never, ever pay those homes off unless they win the lottery.
You were also waiting for the real estate bubble to burst and you were going to go swoop in and get yourself.
Based on all that, based on exactly what's transpired. And
yeah.
I even said Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, these institutions that are doing this lending, that there needs to be, people cannot go to a bank and say, I make this much. And the bank says, okay, can you show me your tax return? Nope. I'm just telling you that's what I make. And the bank went, okay, Those were called stated income loans, and they were all part of the subprime meltdown. Is that people were just lying about how much they made, and were getting loans because the banks, it was in their interest to just turn it over, sell it to the government or these quasi-governmental organizations, which is what Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were. And then they resold that, packaged thousands of those loans, and then sold it on Wall Street to investors all over the world. That's really the fundamentals of what happened. There's two things that happened. That's number one. That's pretty easy to understand, right?
Yep.
The other thing that happened is guys like this hedge fund manager saw that there were these heavily leveraged companies, like insurance by definition is heavily leveraged. I will give you $1 million if something terrible happens to you.
Right.
But until that happens, you give me $1,000, right?
Yeah.
So that's this incredible leverage. And so AIG was the biggest insurance company in the world. And they were the insurance company for insurance companies. And so they were heavily leveraged, just by definition, that's what insurance is. And these speculators, these Wall Street speculators, saw that these companies were heavily leveraged, and if their share price went down, they would have to do something in order to prevent the stock from going through the floor. So there were these groups of investors that were shorting stocks, forcing the price lower and lower, and because they knew these companies didn't have the assets, the cash, to be able to say, no, this, we have tons of money. We're in a liquid position. We don't have so much debt that we can't pay off our creditors if they ever come calling.
I don't have any idea what
really.
Yeah.
Okay, I thought I was using simple terms, but
you are using simple terms, but there becomes a concept.
Liquidity just means I have more cash than assets that have value, right? So, and generally, insurance companies do have a lot of cash. That's why insurance companies take that cash and invest it in buildings. You know, you drive down in any major city in America and you see, you know, the Transamerica building. Well, that's an insurance company, and they put that money to work so that they're basically using the money that you pay in premiums and investing that, so that if you ever need your money, they will be able to profit from their investment and pay you off.
Yeah, that never occurred to me, oddly enough. It didn't.
Well, that's what insurance
never
companies
really thought about.
Yeah, insurance companies don't sit on that money that you pay in premiums. They reinvest it. They go out and buy stuff.
Right.
So that's why, you know, all those skyscrapers all have insurance company names on. They went out and built skyscrapers, and then they collect the rents from all the other people who are in their building.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what happened, is these heavily leveraged companies that didn't have a lot of cash on hand but needed to have cash on hand, like banks, like, you know, like savings and loans banks, like these Wall Street investment banks and insurance companies. They were so heavily leveraged that if these companies, these investors could target them, drive their share price down, they could make incredible sums of money very fast. So aside from the subprime meltdown, there was also this going on in the background. And that's where all the money went. People, you know, wonder what happened to it. Where did all this wealth had to go somewhere? It didn't just evaporate into the ether. And it went into these. A lot of people made a lot of money very fast.
Hmm. Well.
Not us.
No.
Not us. But anyway. So any more lovely stories from Meryl Marco?
Well, here's just here's a lovely fact that was on the front of the science section of the New York Times today. There's, I guess this is in honor of Halloween, they have all the different blood-sucking animals. And, you know, everybody knows about the vampire bat. That's kind of ho-hum. Mm-hmm. We heard about it already.
Right.
But have we heard about the Candiru catfish? A South American fish, an inch long, draws nourishment from the blood-rich gills of fish. These fish are said to sometimes swim up the urethra of humans.
Oh, I've heard about this.
And
that's
have been
why,
called yeah. penis fish.
I've heard that if you're in some, like, lakes or rivers, that if you urinate, they follow your urine stream and, yeah, right up the chute. Yeah.
Penis fish. That's what they call it. They call them penis fish. Can you imagine? Who needed to know about that?
Apparently, they have sharp barbs, so you can't pull them out. Does it say that in the story?
No, I didn't read the rest of the story. Yeah, all I did was read that. You know, there are certain things that really...
Funny that that would bother you more than it would bother me.
Why wouldn't it bother everyone? It's like when I learned about last summer, I went to... where was I? I was in a national park, and we came to a beautiful swimming hole that was an ancient Indian...
burial ground?
On a reservation, and yeah. It was a place where primitive civilization had been. I can't think where I was. Oh, it was the Grand off the Grand Canyon or in that area. Mm-hmm. And this beautiful swimming hole, it was ideal and it was perfect, but for one little detail that God threw into the mix to kind of keep everybody on their toes, check this out. Night swimming scorpions.
Wow.
Who needs night swimming scorpions?
I've never heard of waterborne scorpions.
It was warm water, a beautiful location. You get in the water and everything's fine except for the night swimming scorpions.
On the surface, they swim at the surface, or they actually are under the water?
I think they're wherever they want to be.
Wow, that is a little frightening, yeah. That kind of puts a damper on the evening, doesn't it?
What a great idea.
All right, Meryl, thanks for coming on.
Well, thank you for having me.
Meryl Marco has lovely stories, and we'll kind of make this a regular feature. Is that our plan?
That's our plan.
Great. All right.
All right.
Talk to you later. Thanks for coming on.
All right. Bye-bye.
There she goes, Meryl Marco. And we'll continue. This is TalkRadio1.com. I am Mark Germain. Coming up in just a few minutes, Dr. Raj, his website, drhipandknee.com. We'll talk about how to get quality medical care in this country. Something he's doing to try and help people get quality medical care. And also, which is better, the Canadian healthcare system or ours? He was educated in the Canadian healthcare system, went to medical school there as well, and practiced in Canada and is now here in the United States in Beverly Hills. We'll talk with Dr. Raj coming up in just a few minutes. This is TalkRadio1.com. I am Mark Germain. I want to spend a couple minutes with... Andrew Rache from techpresident.com. This website is dedicated to all the details about how the various political candidates are using, the various presidential candidates are using technology. And we welcome Andrew Rache back to Talk Radio 1.
Thank you.
Last time we spoke, we talked about the new ways that the campaigns are utilizing technology to get out their message. And here we are 2 weeks from the election, and there seems to be new ways. For instance, the Obama campaign using ads inside video games. This has to be a first.
There is no stone left unturned by the Obama campaign to go where they think voters may be and get his message to them in the environment that they're most comfortable in.
Do we know if it's effective? Do we know if it works? And do you think campaigns in the future will utilize ads and video games to get their message out?
I think that we are in an entirely new political media ecology where the candidate or the party that learns how to distribute its message through every available platform, technological platform, whether it be games, mobile phones, mobile applications, music videos, television. There is no one way now that is more powerful than any other. It is a matter of actually weaving them all together to create as much of a presence as possible. And, you know, the 2008 election has demonstrated that, you know, 60% of Americans are getting their political information now online, that the internet is no longer an adjunct but a major part of the media landscape, and every subsequent advancement in the technological revolution, whether it be cell phones or games that allow citizens in effect to do fantasy politics, will be exploited in order to advance political causes.
Well, let's talk about fact-checking sites, viral emails. In fact, there's a post on techpresident.com today about that. How is that changing the landscape, changing the way people view politicians, and specifically these presidential candidates?
Well, you know, the factcheck.org and other sites that are trying to, you know, check their statements are playing a role in a very traditional sense that people are for the most part, leery of politicians, think for the most part that they're not telling the truth or they're parsing the truth. And so the fact-check process, does bring back some reality to, people's attempt to understand, what the issues are and what the candidates' positions are on given issues. But I think that over time, the fact-checking is going to be less necessary because I believe the networked public sphere, people online themselves, people involved in the campaigns, are going to actually demand more accountability and transparency from the candidates themselves. And that it'll be harder and harder for candidates to shade the truth in a way that only benefits them or only use a soundbite in order to make a point as opposed to the full context of a statement. As we just saw with the Joe the Plumber incident in the last debate, if you watch the entire interaction between Joe and Barack wasn't saying he was interested in distributing the wealth. He was basically making an argument that trickle-down economics hasn't worked for America and that we've got to start thinking about, figuring out ways for the middle class to be able to be successful too. But it was taken out of context and distorted by the McCain campaign. Those kinds of things will happen less and less because people will not attach themselves to a candidate that isn't already aware of the fact that the internet forces transparency and more clarity and less sound bites. So, yes, fact-checking is important. We'll always have some need for checking statistics and what's objective and not what's not subjective. But I think that we are still early days of a networked society that is going to be holding elected leaders far more accountable than simply going back to their YouTube videos from years before. They're going to force them to be accountable in real time.
Let's talk about older technology, robocalls. It's suddenly a tool for the McCain campaign. It seems like it's backfiring on them because the message isn't cutting through. At least it's being presented on new media as an old way to spread old lies.
Well, the McCain campaign has, unfortunately, I think throughout the entire election cycle so far, has discovered that negativity has been backfiring on them. And I think that there's a combination of reasons for that. One is that the American public is expecting it and is using it, is expecting to see someone using it, and therefore they're immune to it to some degree. I think also the Obama campaign's attempt, although they've done some negative stuff too, but their attempt to try to cast a more positive, less attacking posture is sort of a little bit of a Taekwondo move that actually using the weight of your opponent against you, it highlights negativity, and therefore that's one of the reasons why it's backfiring. And the reason why McCain campaign is using this stuff is because they have years and years of history from old media ways of campaigning that show statistics that these processes work. If you look at the elections of 2000, 1992, all the way back to the 60s, there are all kinds of examples of negative advertising. But they work until they don't. And I think that we're starting to come into a period of our history where they may not work anymore. And again, I would argue that we have a more sophisticated population that is oversaturated with media, have become media savvy, either subconsciously or consciously, that they are outsmarting the people who are trying to outsmart them.
Why would either of the campaigns spend money in states they know they can't win? For example, why would John McCain spend a penny in California, and why would Barack Obama spend a penny in Arizona?
The Obama campaign is sort of following a much larger agenda, which is to run a 50-state strategy where he really can say honestly he's running for all Americans, and and it dovetails with Howard Dean's attempt to rebuild the Democratic Party infrastructure in every state and fight for every seat in every Senate or every congressional seat. So there is a certain amount of connectedness to the campaigns wanting to appear broad and also to support local candidates that may be running on their coattails in a particular district. They may be more Democratic. Maybe the state may be lost, but the particular district may be Democratic. And so there's some benefit there. But there's maybe another reason, which is that people make their political opinions based, for a large degree, based on talking to each other and sharing their opinions, their prejudices, their aspirations, etc. And those conversations go across state borders. And so if Barack Obama can convince my father in New Jersey that he's the best candidate, my father in New Jersey can send a note to somebody in another state, or vice versa. So the borders of the states seem, you know, they obviously matter in terms of electoral votes, but I think that people are starting to realize that it's all connected and they can't actually completely cut it off. I actually personally think that the McCain campaign's pulling out of certain states was not so much of a strategic move related to the fact that they were going to lose those states, although it was obvious that they probably would, but they were trying to conserve resources, financial resources. If you have the money, then you're going to run in those states anyway.
What candidates other than McCain and Obama have the best technology, utilizing the best technology? Are any of the third-party candidates doing anything?
No. I mean, Ralph Nader has been trying to use his website in some innovative ways, but he himself has not been a big believer in the Internet. I think some of his supporters, because he is, again, there isn't anybody really running his campaign in a very, there isn't a lot of resources for management at his campaign. A lot of it's being done by volunteers. A lot of it's being done from the bottom up. So there's innovations. I saw something very interesting that allows people with disabilities to get information easily through the Nader site. But no, the third-party candidates are still fighting the political war from the 20th century. They haven't quite caught up to the 21st. The only real exception in the last primary season, who was doing something I think far more innovative than the existing candidates, was Ron Paul, who not only used the web effectively in a similar way to Barack Obama, building up a community of interests, but he made his information open and accessible, meaning donors who were giving money to his campaign, where the information about the donors was available right on the site in real time, creating a feedback loop that dramatically increased the amount of money he was able to raise.
You know the people on Obama's new media team?
I do. I know also the people on McCain's new media team, yes.
Well, you began by saying that there's no stone left unturned. What's left? I mean, they've got 2 weeks. It seems like if there's anything left to do, now's the time to do it. What do you suspect we'll see in the next 2 weeks? 2 weeks? Anything? Because I didn't hear anything about, you know, a month ago, I never heard about putting ads in video games. I never heard that it was even possible to do. Are we going to see anything in the next 2 weeks that you think will be innovative?
Who knows? You know, maybe the whole initiative to get the ads on into the video games had been worked on for several months and you didn't hear about it, and then they, you know, because they got so much money raised in September, they realized that they had the extra money to spend, so they decided to go ahead and spend it. So maybe that's why you're hearing about it now, as opposed to something new that was built just in the last 2 weeks. To answer your question more specifically, I think you're going to see them spending almost all their technological energy on getting out the vote, on actually converting all this online enthusiasm into offline action and the field work that needs to be done to make sure that the efforts they've been able to do online are reflected in the physical space and the physical world. So you may see some tools that they're going to unleash to supporters to help them get out the vote, but I think that the attempt to get the message out through the internet is 99% done. And now it's a matter of actually executing on Election Day.
What about utilizing technology to verify votes?
Well, it's interesting you bring that up. I don't know about the whole Acorn controversy over the fake registrations is kind of a mountain out of a molehill as far as we can tell, because even if it was true that some canvassers padded their voter registration rolls with fake people in order to get paid for the number of people that they registered, though, you'd still have to show up at the polls with an ID that matched up with that registration. So Mickey Mouse isn't voting for John McCain or Barack Obama this election. So I think that the voter verification is a state by state, local by local issue. However, we at Tech President have unveiled, and you can find this on our site, an effort to use Twitter to allow people monitoring the polls to be in touch with each other and to alert authorities if for some reason there's any irregularities at the polls, people being kept from the polls, the poll machines being broken, or other issues that may affect the actual process. So you are going to see technology used to try to ensure that the electoral process proceeds smoothly. And of course, as soon as there's any kind of problems, you're going to hear about it first on the internet before you're going to hear it on CNN.
There's been a number of high-profile conservative Republicans that have, in the last few days, flipped for Obama. And it's interesting that the campaign doesn't seem to be really promoting that. Ken Edelman, Colin Powell. Colin Powell got a lot of play this weekend, but Christopher Buckley, the Boston Globe, Christopher Hitchens. I mean, it seems like these are big names for conservative intellectuals that could be used by the Obama campaign to say, look, We've even got the people who should be John McCain's biggest supporters voting for us.
Well, I'm not inside David Axelrod's, strategic mind, or David Plouffe's, the two people running the Obama campaign, enough to be able to tell you why they're not doing something that in your case, as you just described, it seems pretty obvious. They may know in their plan that talking about the economy and talking about Obama's actual specifics is more important. That gets them more votes and gets them more people converting over, and they don't need to, gloat over their success at convincing conservatives. The Obama campaign is going to be analyzed 15 different ways this way and 15 different ways that way. Every 15 seconds, starting November 5th, if they succeed in winning, what they did right, and certainly if they lose, what they did wrong. But I think that they've got a very specific, one thing that they've been able to do is they stay on message, they stay very consistent, and they don't react to every single, event that occurs, even if it benefits them. And that, I think, is one of the things that became part of the general narrative in this election about the Obama campaign, is that he himself is calm, collected, and focused, and isn't reactionary or jumping on every single advantage and pointing his finger and saying, ha, 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 look at me, look what we've done. There's a calm grace and security about the way his campaign is run, and I think that's starting to telegraph to Americans that's the way he may run as president, too.
Andrew Roche from TechPresident.com. Last question, and I guess this is probably the hardest to quantify, but how much better technologically was the Obama campaign to date than the McCain campaign?
Oh, I think that, substantially more successful for the reasons that that they've been running longer, that they believed in the web sooner, and that they understood that the web wasn't about them just broadcasting, but it was actually about listening too. And if John McCain had another year to run, I am very confident that he and his staff would catch up, and that they'd be much more on even par with the Obama campaign.
Andrew Roche from TechPresident.com, thanks for being on Talk Radio 1 again. I appreciate your time.
Great to be here. Thank you.
7 minutes after 9 o'clock on TalkRadio1.com. Mark Germain broadcasting live. Coming up next, we'll talk with Dr. Raj, DrHipAndKnee.com, a Beverly Hills orthopedic surgeon. We'll compare and contrast the American healthcare system and the Canadian. He's worked in both. And he's also got a plan to help people in Southern California who need quality medical care. That's coming up next, right here on TalkRadio1.com, right after this. Mark Germain for the law offices of Glenn Stern. Banks don't want your home. There's a legal alternative to foreclosure. One of the new laws passed in the bailout can benefit homeowners in the following situations. If you have late payments, if your property has lost value, or if you've seen a dramatic increase in adjustable rates. What banks won't tell you is that they can modify your loan, but you need an expert on your side to approach your bank and to know what to say. That's why if you or someone you know is struggling to make mortgage payments before another day goes by, call the law offices of attorney Glenn Stern. You'll get a no-cost initial consultation and evaluation. Glenn Stern has been licensed to practice law in California for over 3 decades, and he's a recognized expert in the field of bank loan modifications. Call 1-866-924-4449 to take advantage of the new law if you're worried about losing your home. The toll-free number to call is 1-866-924-4449. That's 1-866-924-4449 for the law offices of Glenn Stern. Back live on TalkRadio1.com, Mark Germain. Every weeknight from 8 to 10 p.m. Pacific. Scheduled to join us on the show this week. We'll talk with Carol Leifer, also Ananda Lewis, and Bud Friedman, and Danny Goldberg, all scheduled to be on the show this week as we continue on this Tuesday night. Let's talk with Dr. Raj, who is an orthopedic surgeon in Beverly Hills. His website, DrHipAndKnee.com. Dr. Raj, welcome back to Talk Radio 1.
Thank you.
I read a story, and I thought of you, and I wanted to get your opinion about this. This was in the news today out of Dallas, the Dallas newspaper. A woman waited 19 hours at Parkland Memorial Hospital's emergency department for treatment of a broken leg, but never did get to see a doctor, but she still got a bill for $162. A woman named Amber Milbright, who said she broke a bone in her leg while playing volleyball, received a bill 2 weeks after her September 24th visit. Parkland officials said the bill was appropriate because a nurse spent time checking her vital signs to assess her level of need, but that's not how she sees it. She stayed in the emergency room for 19 hours. This is what she told the Dallas Morning News. The assessment by the nurse, which lasted a few minutes, established her place in line that night, but by the time that she had already been waiting 3.5 hours, that's when the nurse took her vitals, she still had not been called more than 15 hours later, so she gave up and went home, had an x-ray taken at a chiropractic school where she is a student, which had already confirmed that she had a fracture.
That is absolutely incredible.
But you hear stories about people waiting 5 and 6 hours here at the best emergency rooms, you know, at Cedars-Sinai, UCLA Hospital. It's not that uncommon.
Absolutely, and those waiting times are getting worse and worse. But 19 hours for a broken leg is unbelievable. But I'm hearing more and more stories of that nature.
Well, first of all, what do you do? I mean, first of all, a broken leg, it looks like what she did is she rested for a few days, put her leg in a brace, because I guess she was a chiropractic student. And she still is wearing the brace, and it seems to be healing. She confirmed that it was a fracture. Not really much else she can do. They can't reset it. There's no real need for a doctor. I guess she was just hoping for a couple $100 without insurance that she'd be able to see a doctor and have a correct diagnosis.
Well, you know, she's lucky. I mean, at least she has some experience in musculoskeletal medicine to a degree, and she knows how to read x-rays. She also probably has colleagues or doctors or orthopedists around that she can consult with, but that's not the normal situation. I mean, first of all, I mean, if you go into an emergency room with a broken leg or, you know, you can't really make a determination on your own if it needs to be set, if it needs to be fixed, because as we know, I mean, there's many different ways and many different type of fractures, and also there's fractures involving joints, fractures that are displaced, non-displaced, but there's many indications for having a fracture set or for an operation that, you know, one, especially a nurse, can't really make an adequate judgment call on.
I have a similar situation. Personally, my wife, it's time for her annual exam, and her doctor gave her, said, here's the lab tests. You need to go get blood tests, just the typical, you know, blood panel. And my wife said, well, do you know how much this costs? And she said, no. The doctor said, you'd have to ask the lab. So my wife called the lab and said, here's the test my doctor wants me to have. How much does this cost? Now, we have insurance, but it's a high deductible insurance. And we wanted to know how much it costs. And so she said, well, you'd have to call your insurance company to find out how much they pay. So my wife called after waiting for 45 minutes on the phone, reached somebody today, and the answer was, we don't know. So my wife said, well, what am I covered for? I don't know. So I'm supposed to, the lab won't tell me how much it costs. The doctor doesn't know how much it costs. And the insurance company won't tell me what it costs. I'm supposed to just have the tests, wait for the bill, submit the bill to my insurance company, and hope that they'll pay whatever percentage that they'll pay, but they won't even tell us what that is. And everyone said, that's correct.
Well, that's the unfortunate aspect with insurance companies. You know, as you know, I was trained, raised, born, brought up in Canada, a completely different system. So even myself, I've only lived in the United States for 8 years, but getting used to the system and the different insurances, HMOs, IPAs, getting used to seeing the discrepancies on what's being charged, seeing the discrepancies on what insurance covers, it's absolutely confusing. And that's for me, who sees all of these bills, who's part of this world. I can imagine a patient or a client who goes to exactly the situation, get blood work done or an x-ray, and you have to figure out, you know, am I getting something that's going to surprise me later on, or down the road at the same facility would have gotten this for a reasonable price.
Yeah, so what do you do? I mean, I suspect doctors are as confused about this as patients are. It seems like the insurance company is the only one who's, I mean, the insurance company really is, they're not just the middlemen anymore between doctors and patients. They're dictating to doctors what you can do and what you can charge.
Yeah, I mean, I fight this every day in clinic when I see patients. I mean, not even on a charge basis. I mean, I allow my staff to deal with that because it's way out of my realm. You know, I've trained to become a doctor, and not understanding the insurance world would take another 6 years of training.
But I mean, if I come in with a broken arm and I say, I don't have insurance, can you tell me what it's going to cost? I mean, you have to give me a price, don't you? I mean, you can't just pick a number out of thin air. I have a broken arm. How much does it cost to fix?
Yeah, I mean, our gold standard is Medicare rates. And, you know, basically, Medicare is the insurance, yeah, the federal insurance for seniors, mm-hmm. that all of these insurances in some capacity base their rates on. Mm-hmm. Now, you may go to one doctor who may charge four times Medicare rates. A second doctor may charge two times Medicare rates, but it's their assessment of their own standardization. But in the end of the day, if you had Medicare, basically Medicare would pay Medicare rates. So, and there's a law against balance billing. So if you saw a doctor and you had an insurance that only pays Medicare rates, or it's Medicare, even though the doctor charges two or four times Medicare, they have to accept Medicare rates.
Mm-hmm. So how much will a broken arm cost me? Do you even know? I mean, or is that something you just don't deal with?
I mean, I try and stay away from the financial aspect,
right?
Because personally, when I start bringing in the financial aspect, first of all, my knowledge is far from superior. I've got billers and people who are involved in me who understand ICDs, which are technical terms, or CPT codes, and what Medicare bills or charges. And the second aspect is, if you came in with a broken arm, although I may set it and I may have my own professional fee, there's also a technical fee or a facility fee.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the hospital. And that's a whole new world.
Wow. I just don't know how anyone does. I mean, I understand if you work for a company and they provide you with insurance and you have full coverage and you just pay it out of your paycheck, and then you go to the doctor and you just know that, you're going to end up paying 10 or 20% of whatever it costs. I get that. And even then, people are shocked by how much things cost. You know, Band-Aids are $27 and aspirin's $12. It's, these kind of cartoonish numbers that we have for especially hospital care, because you're subsidizing all the people who came in without insurance. Sometimes feels like, well, what am I paying for insurance for? I'd be better off just claiming that I'm indigent and going to the emergency, which is probably what happened to this woman in Dallas. Is the reason why she had to wait 19 hours is because there were all the other uninsured people who were bringing in their kids with the sniffles.
Absolutely. I mean, to a degree, as much as people don't want to admit in a professional setting, I mean, especially in a hospital, that probably does happen. Now, on an administrative level, on a hospital level, it should not happen. But, it's a system I really have not still equated with, even though being born, brought up, and raised in Canada, everyone has universal insurance, universal coverage. It doesn't matter who you are. When you get there, you just line up and you see the doctor.
Yeah, how bad are the lines? I mean, this is a great person to have this conversation. You're a great person to have this conversation with, Dr. Raj, because you've been a physician in Canada, a orthopedist in Canada, and you're also one in Beverly Hills. So you've seen both sides. If I break my arm, I know that I can come to your clinic in Beverly Hills and I'll get quality medical care, and I'll probably get it pretty quickly. I won't have to wait for hours and hours like this woman in Dallas who went to the emergency room. But if it's after hours and I have to go to a hospital, I might expect the same kind of thing to happen. Maybe not 19 hours, but I'll bet if I broke my arm right now and went to Cedars-Sinai right now and waited in their emergency room, I'd wait for 3 or 4 hours before I got it. I got a cast put on.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, and 3 or 4 hours is probably pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in Canada, in the better facilities, the university facilities, with a broken arm or a broken limb, you'll be triaged through a lot quicker
mm-hmm.
than someone who has a cold or a flu.
Mm-hmm.
So I would anticipate, you'd be waiting 6 to 10 hours.
In Canada. So the wait is longer in Canada.
Because of the universal system. So what happens is at night, everyone's covered equally.
Mm-hmm.
So people tend to also abuse the emergency room, you know, use it for basic issues. So when there's flu, you know, when we have flu season in Canada, the emergency rooms are blocked up, and there's notices in the newspapers or even on TV saying, you know, please, if you have these symptoms, please don't go to the emergency room at night.
Because there's nothing they can do for you. And the truth is, the flu, there isn't much you can do anyway. It's a virus, and so antibiotics don't work, and just get fluid and bed rest, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean,
you'd think people would know that by now, but although there are these new flu drugs that Flumidine, I guess, is given on the early stages of the flu, and that's supposed to make the symptoms less severe and also the duration of the flu much shorter.
There's newer technologies coming out. I mean, you know, in terms of wait time, this is a great story. 4 years ago, I had a hip issue, and I went for an MRI at a local facility, which will be not named, and I waited 5 hours walking around in my gown, you know, and I'm a hip specialist. But one thing I didn't want to do is I just wanted to see what it was like. I mean, but I was aware that I was going to wait that long, and finally got it done. But I think the justification is I saw all of the people waiting before me as well. So, I mean, realize that the system is log-jammed.
Well, you probably also know, you know, the words to say in an emergency room situation that would bump you up the triage line. You know, if you started complaining of, I've got chest pain, they're going to see you a lot quicker than...
Yeah.
Right? So, I mean, that there are things that a physician would know to say to a triage nurse that would get them bumped up. You chose not to do that.
No, I mean, I didn't have any reason to do it, and I also wanted to just see what the wait was like and
how my
patients would feel if I ever had to make them wait that long.
Was it worse than you thought it was?
It was, actually, yeah. But I'm a fairly tolerant individual. I mean, I've seen and experienced the worst of the worst in terms of our system in Canada. I mean, you know, in general, because we have universal health care, especially on weekends, if you came in with a fractured hip, there'd be a lineup. And on this lineup on the board, basically, is when you would be done. But frequently, what would happen is you'd be bumped by emergent cases. So there's only two sets of teams or four sets of teams or four rooms constantly going. Emergent cases are coming in, and it wasn't infrequent that I would see a fractured hip or a fractured ankle that required fixation on this board for about 6 or 7 days.
If I'm understanding you correctly, the wait times are longer in Canada generally than they are here in the United States. Maybe emergency room for emergency room, you'll probably find horror stories on both sides of the border. But at least in Canada, you don't ever have to worry about filling out. Excuse me. You don't have to worry about filling out a form, and you don't have to worry about whether or not your treatment is going to be covered. You don't have to wait for an insurance agent to certify you. You don't have to carry any kind of a medical card. This is true for people who travel to Canada, too. If I slip and fall in my hotel room in Montreal, I will be treated like a person who lives a citizen of Canada. Will my insurance company be billed for your services?
You know, that's probably what would happen. As someone who is a foreign national who's visiting, your company would be billed, your insurance would be billed, or your traveler's insurance would be billed.
Mm-hmm. And obviously you're here in the United States because doctors can make more money in the American system than they can. Although there used to be a time where, you know, if you said you were an orthopedic surgeon, we just assumed that you had a vacation home in Aspen and you had a Learjet waiting for you at the airport to take you there. Huh?
Yeah.
But
those times I've never seen.
Yeah, those days are over, unfortunately. You got into it a little bit late. But I assume that that's the reason why you are practicing in the United States is because you can make more money than you can in the Canadian system.
You know what? A multitude of reasons. I mean, I was born and brought up in a climate that was cold. I hated the winters as much as I love skiing. The second thing is my wife is very academic, and she's currently at UCLA, and she's a psychiatrist. So we came down for she came down for academic opportunities as well. And with the Canadian system, it's somewhat of a hierarchy to an extent. I mean, the privatization that we have in the U.S., I mean, there's a hospital on every corner in Los Angeles where you could basically put up the shingle and start practicing. In Canada, it's similar. You know, there's one or two hospitals that are in a big city, and basically you're lining up and then waiting for your years to pass by until you have priority to have operative time to do your cases. And I really didn't want to go through that hierarchy, waiting 10 years before I actually had one day to operate in the hospital.
Mm-hmm. So you're happy that you're here, partly because your wife wants to be here for academic purposes and reasons. And do you like practicing medicine here? You've been here for 8 years, or are you overwhelmed by the paperwork and the insurance companies and the bureaucracy that you have to deal with in order to actually give patients quality care?
Well, you know, I absolutely love practicing medicine in general. So, and I generally am a very optimistic person, always looking for something better the next day or the next month to come along. And I'm very fulfilled by my practice and my patients in general. So absolutely, I love practicing medicine. As for the insurance side, that's a whole course in itself. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there are insurance, there are answers I can't give the patients. I mean, well, there's some, there was an IPA I was contracted with just to do joint replacements. That was years ago. And it was great because I'd get these great patients do their joint replacements until I realized that they wouldn't cover any physical therapy. They wouldn't cover any, you know, basic treatments that were needed after the surgery. After the surgery, they kind of shut off. And issues like that made me extremely frustrated.
Mm-hmm. Well, because you knew your patients needed therapy after surgery in order to heal, and if the insurance company isn't going to provide that, then you're only giving them half the service.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's a severe injustice, because as great of a job that any of us can do on a knee replacement or a hip replacement on a rotator cuff repair, mm-hmm. if you don't have guidance, professional guidance on your physical therapy,
you're not going to heal.
Your results aren't going to be as good. Mm.
DrHipAndKnee.com is the website for Dr. Raj. You are offering something for people who don't have insurance and who need quality medical care. Let's talk about what it is that you're offering.
You know, over the years, I mean, I've always treated people, and I really didn't look at the insurance side, and I was fulfilled at doing fractures or helping people out. Fractures, knee scopes, rotator cuff repairs. And as of recent, I mean, there's some hospitals around town where I do some work, some call, and I will treat patients frequently just out of my ethical obligation to do such.
Pro bono, and yeah.
Pro bono. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, what I've done recently is I've implemented a program as part of my service to the community where you just submit, go online and just submit your story to me through my website in terms of what's going on and what you need done. Mm-hmm. I've teamed up with some local hospitals and we'll review your story, and then once a month we'll, you know, provide the services to help this person and whatever their problem is.
Are you looking for sob stories, or are you looking for generally this is going to be people who do not have insurance who need orthopedic surgery, so probably someone the expensive stuff I imagine would be hips and knees. If you need a hip replacement or a knee or shoulder replacement or surgery or arthroscopic surgery maybe, yes. And you have a story and you need help, Dr. Raj is willing to pick a case a month, and he will provide those services and also the hospital care or the hospital services pro bono for nothing, for no charge to the patient. And just go to drhipandknee.com, and there's a place on the website for you to submit your story?
Absolutely.
Go on.
No, and, you know, basically, once you're on the website, what we'll do is we'll review all the stories. We'll get back to everybody. But I have a team that's going to review the stories and then see, you know, who we can help the most once a month.
Well, that's a very generous offer, and that's something interesting. I'd like to hear the stories, especially if it's a listener of mine who ends up getting treatment. That would be a great success for all of us. Dr. Hip and Knee, drhipandknee.com. Dr. Raj in Beverly Hills, an orthopedic surgeon. Thanks for coming on Talk Radio 1.
Thank you.
Good talking to you.
Good talking to you.
Bye-bye, and we'll continue. This is TalkRadio1.com. I am Mark Germain. Back tomorrow night, 8 p.m. to 10 p.m. on the show tomorrow. What do I have scheduled? Oh, Ananda Lewis will be on tomorrow. And also later on in the week, we'll talk with Carol Liefer. And Danny Goldberg is scheduled. Bud Friedman. Bud Friedman from the world-famous Improv will be on. And something else I have. I've got a couple other things scheduled for the show. That's coming up later on this week. I'll be back tomorrow night, 8 p.m. to 10 p.m. right here on TalkRadio1.com. Till tomorrow at 8, why don't you do everything I wouldn't do? Radio.